Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and this is a show where we talk about subjects which are critical to our happiness and spiritual evolution. Please note that all the chat room questions will be answered in the chat room on next week's show, as well as posted on my website, which is davidgagan.com, hopefully within a day or so of the show. When you visit the site, you can ask additional questions, even about other shows. You can listen to any previous show on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com by searching for either David Gagan or Common Sense Spirituality. I've launched a new podcast titled Aspects of Spirituality, which is also on iHeartRadio. There I explain my worldview and what I have learned about the mysteries of life in short weekly podcasts. I hope you'll join me there. The subject of today's show is dowsing. Now, dowsing is often defined as a type of divination employed in attempts to locate groundwater, buried metals or ores, gemstones, oil, grave sites, etc., without the use of scientific apparatus. Now, our guest today is David Cohen, who sees it from an even broader perspective. He's certified in applied nutrition. He embraces quantum biofeedback, an advanced computerized healing system, as both a practitioner and international trainer and educator. He endorses the spiritual aspects of healing, and with his wife, Irina, they teach and train others to become licensed spiritual healers. Their teachings are founded on a non-dualistic principles presented in A Course in Miracles and explained in their co-authored book, Dowsing Beyond Duality. David has also authored Navigating the Collapse of Time and Seeing Beyond Illusions. David Cohen. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thank you. My honor.
Great to have you here. Now, when people think of dowsing, they think of someone walking around in the backwoods looking for water with a twig in their hand. But you have a broader view. Tell us how you see dowsing.
Well, I don't discount that classic form of dowsing. It has a history of going back hundreds of years, if not more. And that form of dowsing really represents a sensitivity on the part of a few individuals to the forces of nature, magnetism, particularly electromagnetic energies coming from the earth, as well as an expanded sense of what the mind is actually capable of. But unfortunately, you know, it was sort of relegated to the realms of superstition and superseded by modern science. Although I have to say Einstein gave it respect.
Did he? I didn't know that.
Yeah. There's a famous quote, which I can't find on the pile of papers on my desk right now, but he said, don't discount it. You know, we can't discount the powers of the mind. I call that classic dowsing because in my experience and investigation into that realm, I was taught that you can take it to another level, which we call active dowsing, where you can interact with the environment, with people on that sort of energetic or subtle energy level, but then actually do something about what's maybe out of balance or missing or lacking energetically. So we've expanded the field of dowsing to actually, you know, incorporate a much broader, as you said, realm. And we've actually rebranded it. We call our form of dowsing mind field repatterning, recognizing that the mind is a part of an integrated field of energy that connects us really on a quantum level with the entire universe. Again, referring to Einstein, he said the field is everything. And recognizing also that the same mind that creates conditions and situations through past decisions, for example, has the power to change our minds about things and can actually change conditions in the so-called real world.
So you say you have a classic dowsing and you have active dowsing. And classic dowsing is kind of Well, I kind of a yes or no. I guess you're walking around the backyard looking for water, and it's either there or it's not. And,
pretty much, yep.
Yeah. And then the act of dousing is what? Explain how that is a little bit broader than that.
Sure. Well, perhaps I could explain it in terms of the actual movements of the pendulum we use. And of course, we don't see the pendulum as anything magical or mystical. It's really just an extension of subtle changes in our physiology in response to certain questions we might ask. With classic dowsing, we're really talking about the same mental physiological pathway we would talk about when we discuss muscle testing, for example. There's a physiological change in response to questions based on a biological intelligence we call electromagnetic sensitivity, or EPR. And in other words, humans, in common with all other organisms, have a natural electrical response to our environment. We are attracted or drawn to things that support us, good healthy food, healthy relationships, good ideas. And we also have a repulsion or a negative reaction to things that threaten us, such as viruses, bacteria, negativity, etc. This is called electrophysiological reactivity, and you can observe it under the microscope. When you watch a bacteria, for example, it'll move towards food, and then when it becomes food, it'll move in the other direction. So that's the biological intelligence that we're tapping into with classic dowsing. And again, the pathway is very similar to that of muscle testing, but the difference being that there's nobody else involved in your questioning. It's a very personal connection. Once that's achieved, though, once you have the answers to the questions, this form of active dowsing. Now, I'll give credit to my teacher Raymond Grace, who's quite famous in the dowsing world as being a highly respected teacher. That was the turnaround in my life when about 20 years ago I went to one of his classes. And he instructed us, first of all, to reconfigure the way the pendulum worked for us so that the yes and no response would come to us in the form of either a vertical or a horizontal movement of the pendulum. And then the spin of the pendulum, which before that time I was, just instinctively getting spins in response to yes and no questions, a right spin or clockwise spin meant a yes, and a counterclockwise meant a no. He basically instructed us to reserve those spins for the active form of dowsing. Now, my quasi-scientific understanding of why the spin is a much more dynamic movement is because it actually, in fact, creates a vortex, albeit a small one.
Now, Dave, when you say spin, you're talking about a pendulum that's kind of hanging there. You're not talking about spinning around. You're just talking about a turn, aren't you?
Well, you hold the pendulum, and you literally start to create the spin on a conscious level. You make it spin, but then the spin, in a sense, takes on a life of its own. It comes from a different level of the mind when you suspend expectation or attachment to the outcome. So when you're spinning the pendulum, you're in fact making a tiny little vortex. Now, physicists know that everything in the universe, from galaxies to electrons, are spinning. Even our planet spins, not only on its axis, but there's a vortex around the sun, etc. So when we use a spin in a conscious manner, we are, in a sense, I call it playing the co-creation game. We're taking a universal dynamic of creation, if you like, and consciously, volitionally, intending an outcome. So in the center of a vortex or a spin, there's an implied still point, like the eye of the storm, for example. It's a gravitational still point, albeit very small. Nevertheless, that still point represents a point of access. According to scalar theory and zero-point energy theory, it provides a point of access into all dimensions of time and space. In other words, you can transcend the limits of your immediate physical experience through the vortex of a spin. Now, I know that that's probably got a few heads spinning.
Yeah, it's even got my head spinning here. And I read the book.
Yeah, there you go. But the results, I guess, is what justifies the understanding, because we do see incredible non-local responses to this kind of work. And we're really tapping into the fact that we are all connected in a quantum field, if you like, on the level of deep mind, And this is very much a Buddhist idea, this one mind idea. We've always been one mind, but the mind has been fractured into billions of seemingly separate parts. And right now is such an exciting time in history because as a species, we're waking up to the realization of this interconnectedness, and it's creating a whole new perception, and it really will be the basis for the creation of a new Earth, is in my understanding.
Okay. Now let's before we get into some of that, and I do want to get into that in a bit of detail. But before, let's talk a little bit more about the dowsing system. Now, you say that the dowsing system does the work, not the dowser. What is the dowsing system?
Well, I suppose it's a set of precepts and principles that you accept when you do the work. And I think it's important to understand the levels of mind when we talk about this, and we talk about a set of principles that unifies the practice and us. I love the analogy of the iceberg. If you imagine an iceberg floating in the water, that 10% above the surface, you could say, represents the conscious mind. And the conscious mind is so full of itself, it's usually not aware of that vast quantity of mind below the surface. The surface might represent our conscious awareness. And from the perspective of our thinking mind, or the ego, we assume that we're separate beings. And we look out across the ocean and we see these other tips of iceberg, and we assume everybody else is in the same state. And in a sense, this is kind of sad because we're not aware of our commonality and what connects us all. And yet, even while that's going on, the deeper level of mind is resting in that ocean. You might call it the big mind, or even source or creator. And we're already connected on that level of that ocean. So dowsing is one way that we can connect the levels of mind, incorporate the conscious mind into the kinds of operations that what I call the superconscious mind is actually capable of and is doing all the time. A big part of this is suspending judgment, and so getting back to the spins, you know, when we set an intention and we create a spin, there's a certain point where I call it putting in the mental clutch. You disengage from any conscious intention or focus on any outcome, and even while you do that, the spin continues. So by default, if the conscious mind isn't controlling the movement, then the superconscious is. And again, it will spin out until the job is done. So again, this is all very theoretical, but people's experience that we've worked with now for many years with this has continuously provided feedback that they feel the results. They have an experience, and that's what keeps us in the game, is that kind of feedback. Even though my conscious mind often has a hard time accepting this kind of non-local connectivity, and yet the proof is in the results.
Now you say that in your book that, you know, obviously as part of the dowsing system is you got the pendulum and our spirit guides are involved in it. Talk about how our spirit guides are involved in this.
Sure. Well, spirit guides is a concept, of course, that cuts across many cultures and has some cultures might describe them as angels or ancestors. And, again, the conscious mind in 3D has lost connection with that level of awareness. But I often refer to the work of Dr. Michael Newton, who about a decade ago came out with a book called Journey of Souls. Now, he was a psychiatrist that used hypnotism to help his patients access deeper memories, and many of them were able to recall what went on in between incarnations, and it's just fascinating material. But one thing they commonly report is reconnecting with a group of beings, disincarnate beings, who in that state are very familiar to us. It's almost like a family or high school reunion when we meet up with this team. And we realize in this state that we're part of a soul family that is devoted to each other's development and growth, and is in fact fact available to us all the time, but in the state, it's almost like we're in a state of spiritual sleep when we come into this dimension. That's part of the challenge, I suppose, of being here. But they're always available should we be conscious and conscious enough to call upon their help. Now, because they operate in the fourth dimension, which some call the spirit world, the spirit world is operates according to quantum principles. In other words, beings or consciousnesses or energies in that realm are not limited to the Newtonian physics of time and space and objects, like we seem to be in the physical world. In other words, a spirit guide can travel the universe at the speed of thought, get the information that you're requesting or that you need, and an attempt to communicate that to you. Sometimes these helping thoughts might show up as the form of an inspiration or an intuition, and we take all the credit, right? Oh, guess what I just thought of? But in fact, we have this network of helpers. And one of the first things we did in the class I took years ago was we, in fact, upgraded our spirit guides. We encouraged them to become more available to us and to become more powerful bearers of light and love. And so that's part of the process. When somebody has a personal session with us, for example, we look into these kind of things and do that upgrade.
The book that you wrote is Dowsing Beyond Duality. Or one of the books that you wrote. Could you explain to the listeners your view of what duality is? I mean, we hear it all the time. If you're in the metaphysical or spiritual realm, I'm not sure everybody understands it. Could you explain that?
Sure. You know, it's kind of like explaining water to a fish. It's the realm that we appear to be operating in here in the human form, and thus we take for granted. Duality simply means the coexistence of opposites. So, for example, in the 3D world, we have hot and cold and up and down and dark and light and happy and sad. And everything you experience here or perceive is counterbalanced by its opposite, beautifully illustrated by the yin-yang symbol, by the way. But not all dimensions, not all realms of existence are in that split state. There is a realm, we refer to it as the fifth dimension, which is the most vibrationally available dimension to us, that is in a non-dual state. And in non-duality, the opposites collapse. In other words, we're talking about the experience of love without an opposite, of life without an opposite, of infinite abundance without an opposite. And to the common understanding, this seems unimaginable, but also sounds like heaven. So this is non-duality. Now, the reason we titled the book that was to make it very clear that our practice was not to keep people mired in the realm of duality. And duality has, well, it's a double-edged sword. The downside is that in duality, you're constantly being challenged by opposites, and therefore it's a setup for conflict. The upside of duality, however, is that being in this state forces you to make decisions. You can't go through a day or a minute, for that matter, without deciding between this or that, between light or dark, between joy and fear, etc. So we've volunteered to come to a dualistic dimension because it's the richest opportunity for us to learn as individuals the consequences of our choices and to begin to make good choices based on love, for example, over fear. Once we've done this, once we've mastered this, and we've become, how can I say, focused entirely only on the love and the light, then we can transcend duality, and we can go into these other realms. So we wanted to make it very clear that our practice was not to keep people mired in the problem. And unfortunately, some healing systems do that by making the problems real and creating identity around them. Even the whole realm of diagnosis creates identity. We didn't want to get stuck in that. So we wanted to make it sure that the purpose of our work is to get out of that dualistic realm, even if just temporarily, transcend the conflict realm and actually experience ourselves as connected to that higher dimension of peace. That's the purpose behind our work. It's not to stay stuck here, but it is actually to transcend. And as you and many of your listeners probably know, many believe that the Earth is in an ascension process now, ascending from a third to a fifth density planet. So our individual aspirations in that area are actually contributing to this collective process.
Now that kind of leads us into your next book, or another one of your books, Seeing Beyond the Illusion. Mm-hmm. What is the illusion that you're referring to?
Well, pretty thing ever with everything we experience here. Probably the simplest analogy would be that of a dream. You know, when you go to sleep at night, you feel safe in your environment. You know you're okay going unconscious because you trust that in the morning you're going to wake up. But in that state, your mind can have all kinds of experiences we call dreams, and as long as our attention is focused in the dream state, we give that all the attributes of reality. No matter how bizarre a dream gets, when we're in that experience, we experience it as true and real. It's only when we wake up that we realize nothing in fact happened. Sometimes we laugh it off, and sometimes we're disappointed, especially when the dreams are good. But nevertheless, we no longer attach any reality to it. We've now entered into the waking state. And I often suggest to people to imagine when you wake up in the morning, you are in fact waking into a more sophisticated and convincing dream state we'll call the waking state. And because this is where our attention is focused on the body and time and space and getting to work and all of that, we give this world all the attributes of reality. As a matter of fact, people call it the real world. And yet, those who have awakened from the hypnosis of their own senses, let's say, realize that there's a whole other realm of existence that transcends the physical world. So, again, this is the focus of practically every enduring spirituality on the planet, is to awaken. And what are they talking about? Awakening from the illusion of separation, that I am limited to a separate body, imprisoned in my senses in the third dimension. There's another part of me that, as the Course in Miracles says, is safe at home while dreaming of exile. So pretty well everything we experience here comes under that title of illusion once we see it from that perspective.
And awakening is realizing that we're really an eternal entity that lives in the spiritual realm, and we're having a business trip, if you will, down here to learn yeah. various things.
Exactly. You know, rather than being humans having an occasional spiritual experience, we realize we are spirit beings having a human experience.
Yeah, right. Is it important to awaken? Why do we want to awaken? We came down here for a purpose, right? If we awaken, do we lose our purpose?
Not necessarily. As a matter of fact, that is our purpose. But there's no, how can I say, compulsion to awaken. Each of us is playing out a perfect script. And again, the way the game is set up is that you can only awaken when your will is aligned with that goal. As long as your will is to stay mired in the illusion, in separation, that's where you'll stay. And this is the absolute trust, you might say, that Creator has in its creations, that sooner or later we'll want to wake up, because inherent in the experience of duality is suffering. Again, and once we get tired enough of the suffering that we experience here, even when we're at the heights of joy, there's usually something that comes along and pulls the rug out from under us, and that's just the nature of duality. That's why I like to call this life Earth School. Because if we're not here to learn through our experiences, really, what's the point? You know, are we here to suffer and die? I kind of don't think so. So, you know, I forget what your question was now. I'm rambling.
Well, the question was, do we want to wake up? And I guess my view is that, you know, we're here to to do whatever we chose to do. And it takes multiple lifetimes to do it. Nobody really knows how many. And I'm sure it's different for everybody, slightly anyway. So the question is waking up. And is it important to wake up? And my view would be that, you know, when our time comes and when we work through a lot of the issues, then we can start to realize that, hey, we're wrapping this baby up, you know? We've mm-hmm. learned most of the things. But maybe there's a few things that are left, you know? Maybe we have scarred ourselves emotionally and we have to, you know, wrap that up. Or, you know, maybe we have some karma lying around that we want to clean up. And it's easier to clean that stuff up in a more of an awakened state.
Well said. Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I see the awakening process.
Yeah, I understand awakening as inevitable. Every seed that's planted in the ground will ultimately germinate and seek the light. And again, the free will sort of cuts in here as to when that might occur. On the other hand, there's a scripted storyline for each lifetime, and in some lifetimes, awakening is part of the story. But I think it's helpful to realize there's a part of us that's already awake, and this is the you might call it your spirit or your higher self. It never left the wakened state. It's the part that never left perfection. Our minds, however, are split between that aspect that's already awake and the aspect that is invested in this experience of separation and duality. So our day-to-day choice might be simplified as to what part of my mind do I want to perceive this situation with. And the thing with the separated mind, the ego mind, is its primary tool to stay mired in the sleeping state is thought itself. See, the action of thinking, in fact, divides reality and therefore commits us to the experience of separation. And this is why practices such as meditation and prayer and communing with nature is so important for those who are focused on letting go of that perception and reconnecting with the part of them that is awake. We all have that spark of divine will or divine presence within us, no matter how mired we may seem to be in the duality, even when we get down to the real muck and depths of the human experience. That spark never goes out because it's eternal. And connecting with that inner spark is how we demonstrate our willingness to wake up. Once we've made a move in that direction, and we do so by saying no to the ego, by saying no to the old way of dealing with things or seeing them, once we commit to moving in that direction, the process sort of kicks in, and it's inevitable that it will result in our complete awakening. But as you said, as long as we appear to be here, we can be here in a fully awakened state. And many of the saints and sages of the past were able to do this. I love what Eckhart Tolle said about those beings. Some of them became historical figures and others we'll never know about. But he called them the early flowerings of humanity. And the beautiful part is that now we're in the energy where, to quote Eckhart again, the entire field is going into bloom. So we're all in a very supportive energy now for this awakening to spontaneously begin to happen on a mass level. We call it the popcorn effect. And we're seeing this now. You know, people that 2 or 3 years ago couldn't give any attention to anything beyond the mundane are now beginning to question things and beginning to wonder, is there another way of being in the world? Is there another way of seeing the situation? You know, current events, I think, are helping to drive this because the insanity of the ego's world is becoming so blatantly obvious. There, you know, many people are getting desperate, but at the heart of that perception is the understanding or the desire there must be a better way. There has to be another way to see things, to be in this world, or what is the point again? And that is the spark. That's the spark coming alive in each and every one of us. And again, we can all rest assured that once that process starts, there's no going back. It's inevitable. Even those who are listening to this program now and are understanding on a deeper level our conversation, what we're really doing is feeding that spark. We're giving it what it already knows. And, you know, the personal experience might be, yeah, I don't understand that, but somehow it feels right. Somehow I agree with that energetically. And that is that spark growing. So yeah. That spark is becoming a flame on this planet now. It is really exciting.
Yeah, see, I agree with that. I think the people are beginning to change their attitude, and we're moving through a stage of humanity that's going to change us really completely. Now, one of the things you said that I really like is you know, say we all we ever experience is ourselves. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, the way the mind, in fact, works, and psychologists agree, is it works through the generation of images. So, for example, when I'm face-to-face talking with another person, in truth, it appears as if I'm interacting with a being outside myself, but in truth, I'm interacting with the mental image I have of that being. It's a subtle difference. I'm interacting with my assumptions about that person, my memories about that person, my projections onto that person. That's what I'm interacting with. And even when they walk away, I can still interact with that image. So who am I really experiencing? I'm experiencing myself. And I call this understanding the result of flipping in instead of flipping out, is often how we deal with this world. Psychologists refer to it in terms of inner or outer locus of control. As long as we are subject to the conditions of the dream, we are, in a sense, giving control to everything outside of ourselves. And I'm just a leaf in the wind, I'm just a victim of circumstance, and there's nothing I can do about the world or the way people treat me. It's a very sad place to be, and very isolated, and of course it describes the condition of the ego, which is the separated self. However, at a certain point, the light goes on and we realize, wait a minute, I didn't really experience that person or that situation. I experienced myself experiencing that situation. In other words, a higher level of inner responsibility clicks in, and I realize that if I'm only experiencing myself, then I am totally free to change my mind about how I interpret that person and that situation. So this is the beginning of a new empowerment where we shift from the outer locus of control to the inner locus of control. And we realize, you know, I'm not the victim of anything other than my own thoughts, prejudices, assumptions, and projections about my world. And that puts me back in the driver's seat. That puts me back in the place of power to change my mind. And this is a very important principle, I think, to understand, is that we never lose the power of choice, no matter what it is we're experiencing. We always can choose how to experience that thing, even though it may assume when we're in the outer locus of control that we have no control over circumstances. From this inner perspective, I'm in control, and I'm only ever experiencing myself. Now, one of the liberating aspects of this is that if this is true for me, then it must be true for everyone else. And that person who's judging me or attacking me or having jealous thoughts about me isn't experiencing me at all. They're experiencing themselves dealing with the image of me. So it frees me from that need to react, from that need to attach significance or meaning on a mundane or ego fear-based level. And all my relationships become a rich resource or opportunity for me to grow into a greater and greater sense of what this self truly is. All I experience is myself actually operates with both selves. We talked earlier about the split mind. There's a spirit self, and then there's the false self or the ego self. One way or the other, depending on which realm we're operating in, we're only experiencing that self. But when we flip in, we start experiencing ourselves as the spirit self, as the empowered self. And again, it's such an amazing journey from that point forward.
So you know it's interesting. So what we're saying is that the world we see, you know, is really a mirror image of what's in our mind.
Exactly.
You know, that's kind of a strange way to look at it. But if you know, it's the glass half full, the glass half empty is a simple, explanation of that. You know, some people see things, the world is a disaster, and other people say, well, you know, the world's kind of under control, you know?
Yeah. And the mirror analogy is very apt, because when you look into a mirror, and when you look into the world, again, you see an image of yourself. But mirrors are never 100% accurate. They can appear to be 100% accurate, but they're only an illusion. And everything that's happening in the mirror is, in fact, reversed. You know, in the physical world, if you're right-handed, in the mirror world, you're left-handed.
Right. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, so the mirror world is totally, that's why it's so crazy. It's so upside down and backwards. Nothing makes sense because it's a reverse image of our reality.
Yeah. You talk a lot about guilt, and you say that guilt is the biggest con game in the universe. Let's talk about guilt for a minute. Tell me your views on guilt.
Sure. Well, I think it's important to understand where it originated, because it really is the source of all of our suffering. And, of course, how we try to get rid of it is we project it out into the world and blame our guilty feelings on somebody or somebody, something else. Anybody will do. You know, the government, another religion, doesn't matter. That's how we try to get rid of guilt. So, obviously, it's the source of a lot of conflict and pain in the world. To understand where it came from, however, is important, because the way the mind works is if it can't see the beginning of a thing, it has a hard time imagining its end. But if we can grasp, okay, where did that guilt start? Oh, then I can imagine it can also end. And the guilt actually started, and this is a metaphysical story, the guilt started at the Big Bang. Before the Big Bang, if we can imagine what must have been before that, and scientists are saying now that the universe, it must have been preceded by an idea. There had to be some intelligence. That's as far as they're willing to go right now. And that's okay. But imagining before the universe, before the Big Bang, all that is, was, and could be in a perfect state of union with itself. And you can call that anything. You can call it Source. You can call it Creator. You can call it Joe. It doesn't care. It's not hung up on labels. But there it was. And, or is. And out of that perfect oneness, a thought emerges, and maybe it was inevitable that this thought had to come up, and all things are allowed, of course, in that place. And the thought was simply a curiosity about, is there anything more? What's outside of this perfect oneness? Almost like a small child, you know, tugging at its mommy's hand, saying, I need to go across the street. I need to see what's over there. And so the oneness, recognizing that this thought came from a part of itself, had to honor that desire, and you could say that it gave that part of itself absolute freedom to investigate the possibility. It's almost like the one said to that thought, why don't you go find out and let us know? And so that was the thought, the impetus behind the Big Bang. The Big Bang, or the universe of separation, was the result of the desire to experience separation. Now, scientists call this the expanding universe, right? But from this perspective, we could call it the escaping universe, where everything that emerged from that decision point was a fulfillment of that desire and seeking its own path of individuation and separation. However, what we didn't count on as part of that decision was that in order to truly have this experience, we would have to forget our connection with oneness. We would have to enter a state of amnesia. Otherwise, what would be the point? How could you experience separation and still know yourself to be part of the one? And that terrified us. It's like a child all of a sudden, you know, the image of a child holding on to his mother's hand in a crowd. And as long as that connection is there, it feels safe. But as soon as mother's hand is gone, terror, absolute terror and fear. And that was our experience at the very beginning. Oh my God, what have I done? What is this state? I've never known this before. And who am I? Right? So we joined everything else and expanded out from that moment, seeking our own path of separation, which we're still doing on this planet. 7 billion beings of us who think we're individuals, all having our own challenges and all on our own, and living that terror. So the original guilt, I call it ontological guilt, guilt for simply existing in what appears to be a form of separation, is the source of all suffering. So how do we undo it? We recognize our tendency to try and project that guilt onto others, onto our relationships, our society, whatever. And we realize that what we're trying to do is pointless. There's no way I can get rid of this guilt by giving it away. It, in fact, increases it. But I can challenge the premise. I can go back and say, you know what? From the perspective of oneness, this whole experience of the separation is in fact not possible. Because if oneness is still oneness, all of this is happening within that greater context of oneness, and I never left at all. Again, coming back to the simple analogy of a dream, I must have simply fallen asleep. I'm safe at home, having a dream of separation. And we come back again to that theme of waking up.
When we have this feeling of guilt, do we need to forgive ourselves for that?
Perfect, of course. And true forgiveness is the antidote to this guilt. And it's hard for us to forgive ourselves because, again, most of us don't recognize the source of guilt in the mind as coming from ourselves. So we symbolically heal it within ourselves by forgiving it in others. Remember, others are only other versions of ourself. So it's a way of taking the conditions we've created and repurposing them to healing the mind of that guilt. So when I truly forgive another, and I don't mean forgiveness in the normal sense, you know, the ego has a sham version of everything that spirit has offered us. There's a sham version of forgiveness, and that version puts emphasis on what was done to me. You know, even that person, you know, screwed me out of $500,000, I'm a better man, so I'll forgive them. Well, what you've done in that version is you've made the crime real, you've established it as an unshakable experience, and then you've preferred to see yourself as rising above that. That just keeps the separation going. True forgiveness is the recognition that what that other person did from the perspective of perfect oneness is simply a call for love. They're acting that way because, again, they're afraid and they're feeling this terrible guilt and they're trying to project it on me. So I look at that person and I realize, you know, I do the same thing. I probably have done the same thing. And so I forgive them, not for what they've done or what I think they've done, but for the mistake of falling for the whole sham in the first place. I overlook their experience of separation, understanding within myself that it was not possible and didn't happen. Therefore, we only suffer for an illusion of ourselves in a state of separation. And this is beautifully encapsulated in the traditional practice of Ho'oponopono, which I write about in that book, Seeing Beyond Illusions. In Ho'oponopono, and again, this true forgiveness is not a matter of feeling like it. You don't have to feel like forgiving someone in order to forgive them on this level. But in Ho'oponopono, you connect with that person and you say to them, I love you. Not on necessarily a human level. On a human level, I maybe can't stand you. But on a higher level, I recognize we come from the same source. We want the same things. And we have the same destiny. How can I not love you? To not love you is to not love me. And then when we say, I'm sorry, it's not for what you did or I did or anybody did, but for the one mistake we all volunteered to experiment with, and that's the belief in separation. And that's what I ask you to forgive me for. Forgive me for believing that we could in any way separate ourselves from perfect oneness and suffer for that. Join me in overlooking the source of all suffering in the belief in separation. And then we say, thank you. Thank you for showing up in my dream and giving me this opportunity to heal my own mind and your mind and the one mind we all share.
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing for us to do because we grow up in a judgmental society. Mm-hmm. And the probably forgiveness is the most difficult thing that we can do, not only forgiving others, but as you talk about, forgiving ourselves for all the things that we do and we think we shouldn't do, and it's just difficult. Tell me, does life have a purpose?
Yeah, again, it comes back to waking up. We're like seeds planted in the ground, and we are, because we are extensions of that perfect light, ultimately our purpose is to live out, you might say, the purpose of that being, to become co-creators. We have misused the mind by preferring perception and judgment over co-creation. And that's what we're here to let go of, is our dependency on our thought-made self. So yeah, the purpose of life, just like you could say the purpose of a dream, I suppose, is to ultimately wake up. But we're the ones that give life that purpose. It's not handed to us on a platter, and no one is going to dictate when we choose to see life from that perspective.
What are we co-creating? Co-creating the universal consciousness? A little tiny piece of it?
Yeah, you could say that. It's co-creating through us. Right now, we're co-creating an insane world because we're operating from an insane premise of separation and guilt.
Right, that's a small thing. That's what we're doing in maybe this life. But we somehow left, as you pointed out, what I call the universal consciousness. And we left the universal consciousness for a purpose. And that purpose was to do something. Was that purpose to learn about ourselves more, to learn about the universal consciousness and bring back some tiny piece of information that maybe can be used, and everybody's bringing back a tiny piece? What do you think?
Well, what feels right is a love relationship. You know, Creator could have just as easily sent us out here perfectly, absolutely aware of our connection with oneness. And then, but a relationship like that, a love relationship like that that's controlled by one of the parties, it isn't real. It doesn't have any substance because there's no free will. To actually leave that state and then out of our own free will choose to return creates the potential for a truly harmonious, loving relationship. Nobody wants a loving relationship where it's dictated by one party. It needs to be a mutual agreement in order to be truly vibrant. So I think that's the point, is we sent ourselves out here in the desire to experience separation, but with perhaps the deeper purpose of ultimately returning by our own free will. You know, the story of the prodigal son is exactly that. The story of the man that left his father's kingdom and all the wealth and to seek his own path, and ultimately through suffering chose on his own to return, and then was embraced with joy. So I think that's the purpose. Is it really comes down to a love connection that is vibrant and live a living sense of commitment and choice on the part of both. Ultimately, our destiny is to merge back into that state of oneness and realize that we never left. So we are talking about Creator becoming us and us becoming Creator. Again, I refer to this planet as Earth School. You could also think of it as Creator School, because we're here to learn how to create experience through our own free will. And the Mayans, they knew this on some level. They captured the essence of this when they said that the completion of the time cycles in 2012 was the door for humanity to finally realize and become conscious co-creators of realities. And what they were saying on some level was that we've always been co-creating our experiences, because again, the separation is an illusion, but what we've been creating has been coming from that state of separation. At this stage of the game, with the collapse of time as we've known it, we are now stepping into ownership of that power, again coming back to ourselves as the source of our experience, flipping in. And when enough of us do that consciously, we awaken to the fact that, hey, we're making all of this up, and we're absolutely free to make up something joyful and wonderful. It's only from that shift in collective consciousness that we're going to be able to create a world of peace and plenty for all. So we've always been co-creators of our realities, but we've never really been conscious of that. That's the difference.
Dave, we've run out of time. Could you tell people how to you know, how to get in touch with you and what you're doing and the such?
Yeah, I'd love to. We welcome people to our website. Arena, my wife and I share this work together, and that's bluesunenergetics.net. bluesunenergetics.net. And on that site, you can find out how to connect with us for personal sessions. We do distance healing with folks using mind field repatterning, typically a Skype session. We have clients around the world now that we connect with. Thank God for the internet. And we also have classes that are both recorded. We have some mind field repatterning classes that are recorded that are available for streaming. And as I mentioned to you earlier, we'll be coming to Florida in April to St. Pete's there, doing a two-day master class in this technique. So, yeah, invite folks to come by, check it out. If you sign up at the top of the page for our newsletter, you get a free PDF on true forgiveness, talking more about how we can incorporate that in our lives and create some healing around us. So, yeah, thanks for that opportunity to share
Okay. And it's David Cowan, C-O-W-A-N, for those of you who want to look him up on the internet. Hey, thanks for being with us, Dave.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been a joy.
Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's show and other shows will be posted on my website at davidgagan.com. You can ask other questions directly by going to the contact section on my website, and I'll publish those answers as well. Also, I cover these subjects and many more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes of both the Common Sense Spirituality Show and Aspects of Spirituality on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.